Our psalm tonight, if you would like to turn in your Bible to Psalm 139, for the director of music of David, a psalm. A song of intimacy with the Lord. One of my favorite psalms, and perhaps one of yours. O Lord, you have searched me, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? And where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me and your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me to the way everlasting. Here's a psalm which obviously speaks to us of the fact that the Lord knows us, and it is in that knowingness that we come to know ourselves. The animals, of course, can't do that. The animals don't know themselves. We may know them, but they don't seem to have a self-concept. I know our dog doesn't. In fact, yesterday I was thinking of how many more years Sunshine had to live. I'm close to counting the days, but I'm at counting the years. And I figured out that Boomer, our first dog, lived for 12 years. We got him when we were first married. And we've been married now going on 22 years. Boomer lived 12 years. We went without a dog for a year. That makes 13. And we've now had this dog about 8 years, I think, somewhere around there. So he must have about 4 more years to live. And I was saying, Lord, hasten the day. We have this marvelous sense of Christian duty in our family, of compassion. Once we have a living thing, we cannot dispose of it. No matter if it wears a diaper, no matter if it snarls at you if you look cross-eyed, no matter if it even bites you. In fact, the dog on occasion has bitten members of our family. And my wife, who is filled with compassion and mercy, reminds me very much of the Lord in this respect, will say to the children as Sunshine's teeth is sunk into their hand, now be careful or you are going to hurt his teeth. If you think I am not telling you the truth, I ask my children to bear witness, am I telling the truth? They are indicating that I am. Sunshine will live not by virtue of his goodness, not by virtue of the works which he has done. He lives by grace. While dogs do not learn much about themselves, we can learn much from them. I think of the times we have slipped a collar around Sunshine. Actually, he's quit wearing a collar. I'm not sure whether that's deliberate or not. We keep hoping, at least I do, that he will run out the door and not come back. If he doesn't have a collar on him, then no one will know who he is. Although it was interesting, when we were gone a few months ago, to the Philippines, somehow Sunshine did get out the door when Evangeline was taking care of him, and he was gone, and Evangeline was very frightened as to what the consequences of that were going to be. And she began calling all the dog pounds. And on the day that he was to lose his life, the next day, she found him, the last dog in the cage. As she made her way with sunglasses through the pound, weeping at the fate of all these animals for whom Judgment Day was dooming. But Sunshine is quite an individual. When we did have him wear a collar, we just simply put Boomer's collar on him. Boomer was a magical dog in our life, a little white poodle in contrast to Sunshine, who's Apricot. And Boomer taught us so many valuable lessons in life, and I miss him still. I kid Floyd Woodworth, who's a friend of mine. This is all not even in my notes, but now that we're talking about dogs. Floyd Woodworth, who's a missionary to Latin America, hates dogs. And we have this running argument that my argument is dogs are going to be in heaven. His argument is that God would not entertain such beasts in his perfect kingdom. He hates them. I proved to him out of Scripture that dogs would be in heaven when I showed him from the book of Revelation that Jesus would come back from heaven riding on a white horse, suggesting to him that if there is a horse in heaven, surely where there are horses, there are also dogs, by way of inference. He was not completely persuaded with my theology on that, and Floyd, I get postcards from him all over Latin America. I got one recently from him. He was in Managua, Nicaragua, and he was telling me in the postcard very tersely about the dogs here he says you would not like. Anywhere Floyd goes, he sends me a postcard on dogs. It's hilarious. But we put this collar on Sunshine that has Boomer's tag on it. It says Boomer, and it gives, and when he has a collar, we let him wear it because it still has a valid phone number. We've had the same phone number for years and years. And a person picking him up would simply call him what the tag says, Boomer, but at least they'd call the right phone number. Sunshine would have no idea, and it would not take as an insult that he was being called Boomer. He really has no concept that he's even Sunshine. He truly doesn't know what he is. He only responds to a soft voice and to happiness. But the name is immaterial. And animals are generally that way. They do not know themselves. Have you ever put a little dog, or a big dog for that matter, up in front of a mirror and said, look at the mirror. You can do this. Gradually a baby will get old enough and you can hold a little tot up and finally they'll say, oh, me, you know, and they'll smile and they have self-recognition. You can put a dog in front of a mirror till the millennium comes. And they're never going to smile or wave their paw at the figure in the mirror. They just are not able to see themselves. So what we've got with a created order in the form of animals is that we know them, but they do not know themselves. How different, however, this psalm is. This is kind of a doggy way into a psalm. But how different we are. For this psalm says, God knows us. But in the process of acknowledging that God knows us intimately, we are given an opportunity to look in a mirror and know ourselves. And the knowledge of God is one that is meant to bring freedom in our own life, self-discovery. This psalm, which so beautifully and eloquently speaks of God's intimate way of knowing us, answers three questions, three really important questions in our lives. First question is, how well does God know me? That's verses 1 through 6. And the answer deals with the omniscience of God, the all-knowingness of God. The second question this psalm answers is the question, how near is God to me? That's verses 7 through 12. And the answer presents to us the omnipresence of God. God is everywhere, present to me. No time when he is absent from me or from you. And the third question that this psalm asks is, how involved is God with me? Verses 13 through 18 say that God is very deeply involved in our lives with his creative power. If we would but take a moment to consider it, he's deeply involved. Let's look at each of these sections of the psalm in turn. One, how well does God know me? First one begins by saying, Lord, you have searched me. I understand the Hebrew here carries the idea of dig, and that it might be just as accurate to translate this verse, Lord, you dig me. Not the vernacular dig that the kids use, but the dig of the archaeologist. If you've ever seen pictures of an archaeologist at work or watched an archaeologist at work, you know that there is this very, very careful layering of the soil. And when something is found, it's very gently removed and very carefully, particle by particle, the dust is taken off, that none of the original thing is at all injured. And the psalmist is comparing God to that. Lord, you're digging me. You know me right well. You dig into me. And the result of your careful digging is that you know me. How well do you know me? Well, here's how well. You know my routines. Verse 2. What routines do I have? Simple ones. When I sit down, when I rise, when I go in, when I go out, and when I lie down, you are familiar with all my ways. That suggests to me that God is more familiar with my habits than I am. If God knows my rising up and my sitting down, my lying down, my going in and out, He's one up on me because I don't even know that. I cannot tell you how many times I've stood up today. I cannot tell you how many times I've sat down, although with 3 Sunday morning services, it must be a considerable amount by now. I cannot tell you probably before the day is done. Maybe I could tell you how many times I've laid down. I haven't laid down once today. And at the end of the day, I will lie down once. How many times have I gone in and out? Well, it depends on what building or room you're talking about. I lose track of those things. Never have. There's never been a day in my life where I've kept a log. Here's how many times I've gotten up today. Here's how many times I've sat down. But this scripture is saying God knows us so well that in those routinized avenues and areas of our life, He's into us and He knows us. How well does He know us? He not only knows our routines, but this psalm says He knows our thoughts. You perceive my thoughts from afar. That is, Lord, you don't even have to be close up to me face to face. You can put your radio wave in on me from a distance and you pick up what I'm thinking. Uncanny, isn't it? People who have been around me for a while always tell me that they can know what I'm thinking by my expression on my face. In fact, Jewel tells me many times she can always read my reaction whenever I'm in public or sometimes in private by just simply looking at me. I recall one time when in our early married life, I was on a Sunday, I had gone down to Silver Dollar City in the Ozarks to be the guest chaplain. They have a beautiful chapel down there that has a window that looks into the gorgeous scenery of the Ozarks. It was fall. The leaves were turning colors. There's no more beautiful place in this whole world than the Ozarks in the fall. And they have this log cabin kind of chapel there that seats about 75 people on hewed out logs, backless if I remember correctly, and a tree stump for a pulpit. It's just a delightful setting. And I, as the visiting minister of the day, of course the advantage of being the visiting minister was that you got 2 free passes to Silver Dollar City and 2 free meals. And as broke professor at a Christian college, that was a very important bonus for that particular year, so I had taken the opportunity to go down. And I was leading the service just really happy. All these people I'd never met before, I could make any mistake and it wouldn't matter because they weren't going to track me. I'd only preached a few sermons in my life, probably up to that time, and led very few worship services. And suddenly in the middle of a hymn, my wife saw my face changed totally, and from a very happy person, my jaw kind of dropped. I went into a state of semi-shock, and what had happened was that 2 people who were very prominent in ministry in the Assemblies of God, D.V. Hurst and Wesley Hurst, walked into that chapel with their wives. And I said, oh no, they're going to hear this today. This is awful. She knew, without ever turning around, that something terrible had happened by watching my face. It's interesting that on the one hand, Jewel tells me from time to time that she can tell what's going on by looking at my face, and yet there are other times she says, I don't understand you at all. Isn't that the mystery of life? That keeps life interesting. God has access to me from afar, is what this is saying. He can read our faces. And when our faces aren't showing anything, He can read the intents of our hearts. I take this to mean that since God can read us from afar, that He has access to both my conscious and subconscious life. Even areas of me that are inaccessible to me, that would only be brought out by hypnosis or some kind of memory recovery. Even those aspects of me, God knows. Well, He knows more than my routines and knows more than my thoughts. He also knows my directions and my choices. My directions and my choices are represented by the phrase, going in and familiar with all my ways. That the choices of where I go, He is aware of. Intimately, He knows me, both in my inside life and in my outside directions. Furthermore, He knows my speech. That's the fourth thing He knows about me. Even before I've begun to speak, before a word is on my tongue, He already knows it completely. I only know the word, but He knows the phrase, the paragraph, the whole idea. It's all complete with Him before I have even begun to enunciate it. Finally, David just gives up and says, well, if you really want to know the truth, God knows everything about me. You hem me in behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. The idea that God knows everything about me is maintained in the phrase, He has hemmed me in. Lewis Stradling has a modern translation of this psalm, which at the close tonight I'll read his translation in entirety. But here, of these verses, he says, Lord, You have an enormous file on me. Your informers report all my movements, and You know what armchair, what theater seat, what office stool I sit on, how I respond to my alarm clock and my early cup of tea, the path I follow to the factory, swimming pool, or church. You even have bugging devices to record my thoughts. You have photostats of all my air tickets, expense accounts, and hotel bookings. You have on tape everything I say in public and in private. How do we respond to that kind of knowledge? The psalmist says, wonderful. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. To think that I'm that important to God. To think that He is personally involved with my life. This idea is so vast and grand, I cannot figure it out. I'm lost in wonder, love, and praise. It's always a wonderful thing when someone who is an important figure remembers who we are or remembers something about us. My memory does not always work so well, but I have had a great admiration for people who have held important positions in our church who have an uncanny ability to remember people's names and what's wrong with them. I remember... when we first moved out here and had been out in Southern California for a number of years, Brother Thomas F. Zimmerman, who was then our general superintendent, came out to Southern California and spoke at a church meeting one time, and we went up to him to say hello to him, and I've known him for years, but I wouldn't say we've been extremely close friends, just I've sat in meetings with him and the like. And he came up to us, and typical of him, his ability to remember everybody's name and everything about everybody. The first thing he inquired of us was to ask Jewel, how is your back? How are you doing? Betty and I pray for you guys all the time, and we're just concerned about your health. Well, he no more, I couldn't believe that 8 or 9 years had gone by, or whatever time had elapsed, since he just knew through a pulpit announcement that Jewel had arthritis in her back, that he would have picked that one announcement up somehow and remembered it. And it was kind of a precious, this person is a caring kind of an individual to remember a detail like that. Wonderful. I wish I could be that way. But I tell you the truth, I feel a little bit differently than the psalmist about how wonderful it is to be known that way. Maybe you feel uncomfortable that God knows you that well. And instead of saying, wonderful, God, You have a file on me. You've tape recorded all my speeches and You've tape recorded all my thoughts. I think that's just great. You might be saying, awful. Oh, God, do You really know that? If God knows everything about me, then let me split. Let me really get out of here. I recall Dr. Willard Pierce, whom I used to teach with, telling the story. Dr. Pierce is in heaven now, and he told when he was a child, his mother used to say to him when he would go out, she would hold her finger at him and she would say, now Willard, remember when you go out today that the eye of God is watching you. He said, all I used to think of when I was a kid of God was this disembodied great eye in heaven. It's like a lens following me wherever I go. I'd get spooked, he said, at the idea of the eye of God. And maybe that's how you feel. Maybe you don't feel it's wonderful that God knows as much about you as He does. But the psalmist is saying to us, be encouraged. You're personal to God. You're not a blip on the screen. You're not a computerized number. God doesn't have a card on you that says don't fold, spindle, or mutilate. You're a real living person, and He has access to you. He knows you right well. He is omniscient, which means He not only knows everything about the world in which He is created, and which makes gravity and electricity and everything, the planets and the stars hang in motion. He knows everything about you, what makes you tick. And that is meant to be a comfort to us and not a threat. How well does God know me? Very well. How near is God to me? That's the second question that this psalm addresses. Lord, is there anywhere I can go to get away from You? There are some places this psalmist contemplates about getting to where he might escape the presence of God. And he comes to recognize, first of all, that God is with him in the heights. If I go up to the heavens, You are there. It was a Russian cosmonaut who first went up into space and came back with the famous quote, "When I got up into space," he said, "I looked around and God was not there." To which an American astronaut replied to him in the press, "If he had stepped outside his space capsule, he would have met God." He is in the heavens. You're familiar perhaps with the poem that John Gillespie McGee wrote when he was 19. He was killed at that age. He was a young airman of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he wrote this immortal poem which speaks of God's presence in the heavens through the eyes of a jet pilot. "Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wing. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling myrrh of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my aircraft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the wind-swept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. If I go up to heaven, He is there." David says, "He's not only with me up there, He's with me down there. He is with me in the depths. If I make my bed down there," and by depths here, the Hebrew word is sheol, S-H-E-O-L, which in David's time was simply a place used to describe the dwelling place of the dead. "If I go down underneath, He's with me there." And by the way, have you ever asked yourself why it appears in some of the parts of the Old Testament that the writers do not have a very clear understanding of the afterlife? And in the early years of the Old Testament, Sheol was both the holding place of the righteous dead and the wicked dead. As the prophets came along, they gave to us further insight to understand that there is a great gulf fixed between the two. But it's like, I think, Sheol for a person like David was sort of like Southern California on a foggy morning. Everything is really there on the landscape, but you just can't see it because the fog has moved in. And where there's not the bright sunlight of revelation, people like David did not always see clearly everything that was there. That's what we mean by progressive revelation. As the sun of Christ's presence becomes brighter in the Scriptures, the mists fly away. He simply looked down at death and said, "Even there in the depths, You're with me. That can't separate me." And that's a good thought, because David is saying death is not the cessation of my existence. He's with me down there. He's not only with me up there and down there, He is with me on the horizontal plane. He is with me in the distance. If I rise on the wings of the dawn and settle on the far side of the sea. From one span of the horizon to another. To Manila tonight and Hong Kong, where there's 17 hours ahead of us and they're already into, what is it, 10 o'clock Monday morning. It's already that time there, somewhere around there, if I've not added that up correctly while you help me with that. Maybe it's 15 hours difference. but He's there. And He's with me in the darkness. In the darkness of the physical night, and He's with me in psychological and spiritual darkness. Darkness represents the times in our life when we are simply stumbling and we don't know where we're going and we seem hopelessly lost and confused and there is no light. Who of us who has not wrestled with life and wrestled with God have not had those moments when it has been darkness around us and we have not seen clearly enough to put one step ahead of another? Lord, You're with me in the darkness, and there You seek me out. Surely the darkness will hide me, I said, and the light will become night around me, but the darkness will not be dark to You. The night will shine like the day, and the darkness will be light to You. This whole idea that God is with us in the heights and in the depths, in the far places, and in the distance and in the darkness, all of that is saying to us that God seeks us out, that I am never alone from His presence. Maybe you're familiar with the poem, The Hound of Heaven, which was written by Francis Thompson, who died in 1907. It's one of the classic poems in religious literature. I'm going to cite a bit of it in just a moment, but I'll just mention his background because it's important to understanding this whole idea of how, in a literary way, Francis Thompson traced Psalm 139 about God's presence being with him in the distance. To gratify his father's ambition, his dad wanted him to be a doctor. Francis Thompson had embarked on a medical career, but failed his final medical exam, which disqualified him from being a doctor. He sought refuge from his reproach and he went to London and he lived a life of obscurity in London. At first selling books, later working in the book business, he failed both as a bookseller and as a clerk in the book trade and finally enlisted as a soldier. He was discharged from the military for incompetence. Hey, this guy's not going to be a success, is he? Failed as a doctor, failed as a book dealer, failed as a soldier. And after his discharge from the military, he lived the life of bitterest poverty. It was the days before Social Security or any welfare programs. He was finally reduced to selling matches in the daytime for a living and sleeping on the Thames embankment in the great out-of-doors at night. He was in very poor health. He was addicted to drugs. And he turned to writing in that condition. He was found by a poor Christian couple who brought him back to health, who took him into their home and nourished him, and in bringing him back to health, brought him back to faith. As he came back to spiritual and physical strength, he realized that in all those days of darkness, sleeping on the Thames embankment, being addicted to drugs, being poor and cold and miserable, that in all those years, God had never quit looking for him. So he wrote this majestic poem called The Hound of Heaven, in which he compared God to a tracking dog who is hunting us down when we have wandered far from him. He writes, I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him. But with unhurrying chase and unperturbed pace, deliberate speed, majestic instancy, they beat, and a voice beat, more instant than the feet. All things betray thee who betrayest me. That voice is round me like a bursting sea. Lo, all things fly thee, for thou fliest me. And in that running from God, he found he did not have legs fast enough to escape the nearness of God to him. David is saying, I can't get away from you, God. My sin can't remove me from you. The darkness of my life, the difficulties of my life, the travels of my life, I can find no place where I am absent from you. David then addresses the third critical question, not only how well does God know me and how near is God to me, but how involved is God with me? How directly is he involved in my life? Verses 13 through 18. He has not been imagining all this of God knowing him and being present with him. For God has been with him, and he's been with you and me from conception, and if we understand the New Testament rightly, even before. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. The word for knit is the same word in the Hebrew language used to describe a beautifully embroidered cloth, intricately and gloriously made. You knit me together. We realize that these verses have become very important in the abortion controversy today because they tell us that God is at work in our life when it is yet in the womb. We are being knit by God and made by Him, and He knows our unformed substance. When we are woven together in the depths of the earth, a metaphor from creation where Adam and Eve are made from the clay, the depths of the earth, so the womb is seen again as that place out of which God makes clay and makes it live. The miracle of conception. Carl Olson several years ago wrote an article called What is Man? He is a scientist who is Christian. I almost said he's a Christian scientist, but I realized that was wrong. And in his little work, What is Man? He tells us medically what is happening in conception. And I quote, "In conception, a human sperm and a human ovum unite. And in that union, the payload is a data system containing the entire program of possibilities for the physical, intellectual, psychical, and spiritual life of a human being. According to the best estimates, that data system, in conception, has no less than 10 billion pieces of information, 10 billion separate entities or entries. If printed out, this information would need at least 1,000 volumes of 500 pages each." What he's saying is if you could get into the data that is in the submicroscopic moment of conception when the human egg is fertilized by the sperm, if you could get the data out of that, it would print a library of 1,000 volumes. I have a 500-page volume with me. I have a set of these green ones on my shelf, and as I looked at my library, I thought, I wonder how much space it would take up from this printed information from this microscopic part that was once me many years ago. And you would have to have a shelf that had 100 of these books, which would, I think, make it about 18 feet long, 10 shelves high, about 9 feet above the ceiling. That much information in all these green books would be needed to print out what you are, what you were in the moment of conception. Carl Olson goes on to say, "Now comes the shocker. That whole data system, that library of information, with its billions of complexly interrelated messages, is contained in so minute a space that it is invisible to any but the most sensitive electron microscopes. The naked eye can detect an object 1/10 of 1 millimeter, but the space I am speaking of is 1/50th millimeter in diameter. From this infinitely small data system, the mystery of human existence is spelled out second after second and day after day until a person's destiny has been fulfilled." What verses 13 through 15 are saying, God has been back of us in time, assuring our identity. He has allowed to stream into us from past generations the millennia of capacities, traits, and characteristics which make us you and me. He has ordained my blue eyes and red hair and left-handedness and drooping shoulders and balding. He was aware of that. It was all in the gene structure to begin with. God wrought me in the womb. Let therefore no one think me and you as unwanted or not special. For when God's eyes beheld my unformed substance before hands and arms and legs and feet and nose and mouth began to emerge, when God beheld all of that, He was pleased. That which some people regard as an impersonal collection of cells rolled up in an embryonic state, God sees as my unformed self. God is not only with us in the womb, but with us through all of life, as verse 16 says. All the days ordained for me were written in your book. He's made this miracle machine with its nonstop motor, the heart, its own fueling system, the digestive tract, its own filtration system, the kidneys, its own temperature control, sweat glands. Indeed, He has made us a miracle. And all this knowledge that God is so intimately aware of our bodies and that God is intimately aware of my direction in life suggest to me that God is not going to leave my fate to chance, nor is He going to let me dissolve into extinction. When I awake, the psalmist says, you are with me. And I think that phrase in verse 18, when I awake, I am still with you, or you are still with me, is a metaphor of the resurrection. That is, there is going to be a time when all the details that God knows about me will also be known by me about myself. I can recall holding our children when they were small and being very conscious that at that moment they were sleeping and being aware of the fact that in that moment they did not know my thoughts toward them. And I was assured in those moments at the same time that God held me in moments when I did not know He was holding me. And as an earthly parent can have feelings for a child when the child is not aware of them, so God feels toward us. All this knowledge is so wonderful that the psalmist can say, how precious to me are your thoughts, how vast is the sum of them. Let none of us think that God has a little view of us. This brings us to the final part of the psalm, which contains a concluding prayer, verses 19 through 24. The prayer asks for two things in light of the intimacy that we have with God. The first thing that David asks for in his prayer is that God will do something about the evil around him. And then the last thing he asks for in verses 23 and 24 is that God will do something about the evil in himself. This psalm reads so well until you hit verse 19. And then when you're reading this psalm in public, the tendency is to totally omit verses 19 through 22. They grate on us as being insensitive. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Isn't that a comforting thought? Do not I hate those who hate you, O Lord? And we want to say to David, but David, where is this business of forgiving your enemies? How about this wonderful pure thought of verse 22? I have nothing but hatred for them. You think you could get away with that to God? Come to Him in prayer tonight and express all these beautiful things about how near God is to you, and then say to God at the close of your prayer, oh, by the way, God, I want to talk about some people that I don't like too well. You hate them too, God. Get them. And I keep on hating them, O Lord. Aren't I a good believer? Kill them, Lord. What do we do with phrases like that in the Psalms? Well, the one thing we do is to recognize that the Psalms contain the prayers of God's people. And not always do God's people pray according to God's will. I think that's one thing that can be said. I read some of the prayers of David and I say, oh, David, you're a man after God's own heart, but you missed it on this one. David didn't have the greater understanding that his son, David's son, the Lord would give when he talked about forgiveness. It's always an easy solution to the problem of evil to say for God to knock out the obstacles in our life. The good thing about David is at least he doesn't volunteer to go kill anybody. He leaves it to God to deal with the problem. But there is, on the other hand, a sensitiveness in these verses that tell us that when we become aware of who God is, we really care and begin to care about the evil in this world. And our language may not take the verbiage of, oh God, kill the wicked. But on the other hand, if we are close to God, we are going to feel strongly about injustice and wrong. In fact, this week on Thursday, I said essentially the same words that David said, only I said them casually and not in prayer. Although I was really mad, wasn't I, Wayne? Where I was at Royal Family's kids camp, taking the grand tour on Thursday afternoon, watching the kids at work, seeing them at their crafts at the swimming pool, and I went past this one workstation where Rick Carlson had been the counselor for these two little kids, and they had, I guess, been the toughest two little boys in the whole camp. Rick had to sleep between them in a mattress on the floor, keeping his hands upon them all night long because the kids were just so severely emotionally disturbed they'd wake up in the middle of the night screaming with terror and fright. So I walked past this workstation where Rick was working with these two little kids. Rick was trying to help this kid put together a woodcraft and also do a painting. And this little kid could not get it the way he wanted it. He had evidently been so maligned and criticized and batted about as a tyke that he couldn't take happiness in anything he did. And he just erupted. Every hour he had a number of angry eruptions. And he was so distressed that his paintbrush had gone slightly the wrong way on the thing that he was making that he began swearing in language that would be appropriate to someone who was, it would never be appropriate, but you would expect to hear these kinds of words on the lips of grown men. And he let loose a string of profanity, crying and screaming. And the little kid who was his friend, who Rick was with, it was sort of like he was over there and he saw that his friend was being upset and he couldn't miss this opportunity to really goad him. So he says back to him words like, "You blankety blank blank, you can't do anything right, you blankety blank blank, you're just a blankety blank blank." And this sets off the kid who starts shouting at him and screaming. And I'm hearing all this, this little about 7 year old. Would you say a 7 year old? And you know, I get so angry. I'm not angry at the kid. I want to find who the parents were who did this to this kid. And I said to Wayne, "It's time to put capital punishment to people who do this to kids. Let's get rid of them." Angry. There ought to be a way to fry people like that. Sorry. That's how you feel, isn't it? You get around injustice. The problem, I sometimes get worried about Christians who are never angry about anything. If you're not angry about anything, you're not dealing with any injustice in your life. You're not dealing with any injustice in the world. You're simply going to heaven in a basket. An insulated basket. Go out and get mad. Don't be like Gene Scott, but go out and get mad about something. Find something to divert your energies to. Say, "Oh God, we've got to do something about this problem. We've got to do something about the dopers, and we've got to do something about the pornographers, and we've got to do something about the injustice in our culture. We've got to do something about something," but don't just sit there. Cry to God, "Oh God, do something about my world." And then David says, "Oh God, well, I'm asking for everybody else to be changed. I guess I got to be honest. There's a lot in me that's undone. So search me, oh God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts." Isn't it interesting to compare the end of the psalm with the beginning? For the beginning of the psalm says, "Oh Lord, you've searched me. You dug me real good." And that searching of verse 1 suggests to us that God didn't wait for our invitation. He just up and did it. But now, having worked through the psalm and come to a better understanding of the intimacy that God has with us, David is saying, "Oh Lord, I know you know me, but now you have my permission. Go ahead and search me. And search me with a view not only to knowing me, but search me with a view to removing from me the things that offend you. Help me in the way of everlasting life. Go to work on me, Lord. Root out the evil in my life." That's a powerful prayer. And we really grow in God when we're honest with Him from our hearts. Well, I mentioned a while ago that I wanted to read in entirety the translation that Leslie Spradling put to this entire psalm, which I think fleshes out its meaning for us, and I'll read this as a conclusion. "Lord, you have an enormous file on me. Your informers report all my movements, and you know what armchair, what theater seat, what office stool I sit on, how I respond to my alarm clock and early cup of tea, the path I follow to factory, swimming pool, or church. You even have bugging devices to record my thoughts. You have photostatic copies of all my air tickets, expense accounts, and hotel bookings. You have a tape on everything I say in public and in private. You created me and you sustained me to the last detail. Lord, I don't know how you do it. I am astounded by your incredibly detailed knowledge, and I cannot begin to compete with your efficiency. However unrecollected I may be about you, and I'm often very unrecollected both in my prayers and outside them, you are always recollected about me. At first I found your knowledge of me to be paralyzing rather than liberating. You as the divine voyeur, terrified me. How dared I speak or act when the expert was watching me? So my first reaction was a desire to escape from your surveillance. Yet I knew that your wonderful and excellent closeness to me was in my own best interests, and I came to thank you for it and for the way in which it brings to fruition whatever good seeds you have planted in me. In any case, it is futile to want to escape, because I could not do that if I tried. If I climb up into heaven in prayer, friendship, relaxation, you are there in love. When I am in the hell of sin and rebellion in a place so unclean that I should not have expected to find you in it, you are there in judgment. If I take the morning jet and fly to the most distant spot in the world or to the frontiers of faith and suffering, you meet me there and hold me fast, for your love has no limits. When the night closes around me and the darkness steals over me, the darkness of criticism, failure, pain, and death, that darkness will become as bright as day, because darkness and light are both under your control, and you are the light of the world. Realizing your closeness to me, I turn to you in penitence, certainly, but also in trust. Your care of me is shown by my creation, for which you were personally responsible, by the miracle of my existence, which began when I was conceived in your thought, eons before I was conceived in my mother's womb. Your counsels, your thoughts, are precious to me, although often I do not understand them, for your thoughts, divine thinker, are higher than my thoughts. You would not have created me if you had not loved me. I know that I am not an unwanted child, so I can approach you with confidence. Lord, I hate evil because it is done before your eyes and it is offensive to you. I pray that evil may be overcome and that I may take my share in overcoming it. But I do not say this imagining that I am already perfect. I know that there is evil in me too, and I am ready to face up to your audit, however painful that may be. If I am on the wrong line, I trust that you will put me straight and renew me in such a way that I may find happiness in the integrity which you have given me. Lord, above all, lead me in the way that leads to eternal life. O Lord, you know me.